originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio, and I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to help support the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. Our guest this evening will actually be telling us more about the PDJF and a wonderful organization he is directly involved with called Jockeys and Jeans. In addition to the great work he does there, he was a very successful rider in the 60s and 70s and went on to become a very talented photographer and businessman. He's worn many hats and he's accomplished so much. I'm very proud to introduce our guest this evening, former jockey Barry Pearl. Barry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Christine. It's great to be here, as HRRN is a big sponsor to PDGF and has helped Jockeys and Jeans to our young career.
Well, Barry, let's start off with talking about the great work that you do. And I've looked at your website a lot, and something that really hits home for me and you, I'm sure, as well. We were the lucky ones. We were able to walk away from the sport that we love so much, and so many of our fellow riders were not able to do that. And so what Jockeys and Jeans and the PDJF, what they do is so important. And tell us exactly what does Jockeys and Jeans have to do with helping our disabled riders?
Well, to start the story, you really have to start at the beginning of Jockeys and Jeans, which is only 3.5 years old. And I live in Florida during the winter, and a number of my old riding pals, Eddie Donnelly and Darryl Brown, Barbie Joe Rubin, Mike Maganello, wanted to get together at Tampa for a reunion. And Eddie, being a reverend and always looking to help people, he suggested we do a fundraiser because we know, obviously, you know a lot of the old Hall of Famers, and we could get some folks out there. And so with very humble beginnings, Tampa agreed to let us hold our first event there. And in all reality, this is a little side note, but it was important. I hadn't been around a racetrack for 30 years.
Wow.
And really only kept in touch with a couple of my old friends, Arnie Eliscu from Pennsylvania and Walter Blum. And so now here I'm kind of being dragged back into it. With this event. So we did it. We raised $23,000, and it kind of hit me again that I saw kids like Mike Strait and Ann Von Rosen and those folks and said, you know, this game's been really good to me, and we have to give something back. And so that's really how we started, very humbly. As of today, in 3.5 short years, we've raised over $650,000 for the PDJF, which I'm very proud of.
Wow. That's a big number, Barry. You should be very proud of that. And it's continuing. You were just talking to me before the show here about the next event you're preparing for. And tell us a little bit about that.
We're going to a place that I didn't ride there because I rode down the street at Old Liberty Bell when that was open at Parks Racing in Bent Salem. I had many successful year at Old Liberty Bell, which is, again, right down the street. And so we're going to go to Parks this year. We have just a great big event scheduled. We hope to have maybe some Eagles that might come. I don't know. Parks is going to work on that. And we like to invite other sports figures from different venues to our events. They really seem to like it. The fans like it. And, of course, our handicap riders like it because they get to meet these guys and gals. So it's a lot of fun. We expect a huge event there.
That sounds like a great, great event with so many people going to show up there. And tell us more about that event. Will there be an auction? Will you just meet all of these celebrities? Yeah. How does that work?
Well, we invite as many Hall of Famers as we can get in. Last year, I think at Gulfstream, we had 14 or 15. Guys like Latif Pinkay, who is one of our biggest boosters. Chris McCarron, Pat Day, Donnie Pierce. The list goes on and on and on because these guys just won't refuse us. They say, yes, of course we'll be there. So they come, and we're so happy that they do. We'll have an auction again, and an auction of racing and non-racing paraphernalia and memorabilia, and we find that is very successful. People love buying that. Matter of fact, we have a print of Songbird signed by Mike. Mike's one of our ambassadors out in California, and I asked him if he could send me something for the auction. He sent me this beautiful replica print of an oil painting that he had made of Songbird by Mike Nick Martinez, who is also a handicap rider. So we'll have a great auction. We're starting to take get information about the donations for our auction, and folks can contact our donation part if they want to donate something valuable for our auction, and they can send it to me an email, Barry, and just send it to jockeysandjeans@gmail.com, and I'll get it. Besides that, we're going to have a great luncheon that we will have. Parks is putting on a wonderful spread for us, just really big time. And we sell tickets to the event around the local area. The regular tickets will be $40, and we discount down to $30 for ex-jocks and for anybody that's a horseman. So we try to give a little break to the folks that are involved in the industry. This year, I hope to do something different. So this is something just between you and I. Don't let it out the door. We will try to invite some wounded warriors.
Really?
So, it was an idea from Ruidoso Downs. They just did a sponsorship, first time for them coming on board, and they said they would like to donate their tickets to some wounded warriors. So I was thinking, gee, we have a lot of folks just like that, great sponsors who can't be there. And I'm going to ask a few of them if they would be kind enough to donate their tickets. And we're going to try to get a hold of some wounded warriors so our wounded warriors can meet our fallen heroes. And that's what we call our handicap riders, our fallen heroes. So we think it's going to be cool. And it's going to be huge. And I don't think there'll be a dry eye in the whole place when those two groups get together.
Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine. And I'm thinking, I rode at Parks and know the place very well. I'm thinking I might have to make a trip over there. That's coming up in June?
June 3rd, we're going to have it. It'll start, I guess, around noonish, around there. We'll make the actual formal. Well, June 3rd is locked in, and the time it will be. And usually we start about 35, 40 minutes before the races, so everybody can get in. They have an opportunity to, say hello, and, we start lunch. And so, yeah, it's going to be really pretty neat. And Parks, I just want to say this about Parks. They have been absolutely a home run. It's almost amazing, Christina. Everything I asked for, and I asked for a lot, they said yes to.
Wow.
So I am just more than thrilled with management, Joe Wilson, Sam Elliott, and his, their crew, on how just wonderful they have treated us.
That's awesome. That's awesome, Barry. Mm-hmm. I saw an announcement, and it made me smile, because when I think of parks, and I rode there a couple years, when I think of parks, I think of someone in particular who is very near and dear to my heart, and I've had him here on the show before, the great, the only, one and only, Tony Black. And he's now part of Jockeys and Jeans. Is that correct?
Yeah, Tony. Tony did me a big favor when they had the PA Derby and the Cotillion. I wanted to get out and see some folks, and I know Tony's unbelievable. He knows everybody there is to know there.
Yes.
And so I called him up. I said, "Hey, Tony." I said, "I know Tony since he's a baby almost. You know, I mean, he was. You know, I remember." I was riding when he had the bug. So I called him up, said, "How about meet me out there?" Well, he brought everybody in the world, Tony knows, and it was amazing. So he introduced me to Miss Chapman, who owns Smarty Jones, and she actually, right on the spot, said, I'm going to commit a stallion season to Smarty Jones to you guys right now.
Wow.
So then we went to the jocks room, and I ran into some old friends of mine who were riding there, Mike and Javier Castellano and some of those folks. And so it was really a cool day. So I said, you know, I need somebody in that area that can represent Jockeys and Jeans. And I don't think there's anybody that would have been better than Tony Black. So I called Tony and asked him if he would accept a position as an ambassador, which is a very important position in our organization. We take it very seriously. And some of our ambassadors are Chris McCarron, Lafitte, Georgia Velasquez, the list goes on and on. So we are very proud that Tony could join that great group of riders and become one of our ambassadors.
That's great. Tony's such a great, great person and quite a character. So that is great news. And you mentioned ambassadors, and you mentioned so many big names and great people. And what exactly do they do? Is it just trying to get more sponsors and hosting events and things like that? Or what exactly does an ambassador do?
We don't ask them to go hustle people. You know what I mean? As far as sponsorships, although if they want to, they can. But if I need something or in an area, like let's say, if I need something in California. Now I can go to Mike or I can go to Lafitte. If I need something done in New York, I can go to Georgie, Velasquez. So Kentucky, you know, I have Chris. So we have people that, you know, I can just say, hey, would you go talk to this guy for me? Just tell him about Jockeys and Jeans and let him know that, you know, we're legit and we're here to stay. And with you, with you talking to them, that will give a lot more credibility to us. So it's a name recognition, and having great Hall of Famers like that on our team is just a big deal.
I failed to mention, Barry, that the reason you are so active with Jockeys and Jeans, you are the president of this wonderful organization, and so has to be a lot of work to keep everything rolling along and this big event coming up in parks. And what a really, really great thing you do, Barry. And again, I just, it's such a wonderful thing. And for me especially, you know, I had way too many injuries during my career and had to retire. And I was so fortunate to be able to walk away from what I loved. And
Yes. This
is just, you know, I went to jockey school with Mike Strait. And we were in the same class for years. And
Wow. What
happened to him is just so sad. And Anne Von Rosen, we've had her on the show. So what a wonderful thing that Jockeys and Jeans does to help the PDJF and provide financial assistance for these riders, because they have astronomical medical bills. I can't even imagine. And just normal, everyday living bills that cost money. And they're not able to work. So So yes, what a wonderful organization you are involved with.
Thank you very much, Christina. Well, I'm amazed. I'm a fortunate guy. First of all, I'm a very lucky person. My career, I was right at a time when If you walk sideways, people were mad at you. I was not the for quite a while in my career, I was not the most attentive guy, and I paid for that. But then I came back. I got married in 1968 to my lovely wife, and I figured, well, I better start doing things right now, and I better get busy because I have a wife and a kid on the way, and I did, and people who had known me and trusted me and gave me an opportunity to get back. But the game was good to me. It opened the doors to many other things for me. As you were saying, yes, I was a photographer. I became the track photographer at Penn National. I built a studio in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I built a real estate holding company, which I had a number of properties. And I had a business. So, yes, that all came from my determination and my forward thinking on how I could do things. When I got back into the racing game in this capacity, I'm retired. I've been retired for a number of years from business. And I said, I'm the only one who has time to do things. Eddie still works. Some of our other folks still work full-time jobs. So I brought to the organization and committee, I said, I think we need to have structure, and I think we need to have some people in place that can do things. And I said, so you guys got to decide on the president. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but they chose me. So I try to lead the ship down the right path. I try to expand Jogging Jeans every year into new areas. We started doing then that this wasn't my idea, but we all took it and ran with it in their stallion seasons. We sell stallion seasons now once a year, usually sometime in between November and February. And the breeding community, the stallion community, has just been unbelievable to us. I mean, just have been so generous. Lane's End, Calumet, Darby, I can go right down the line, every major farm in the country, basically, who said, yeah, we want to help you. And we're growing in that area. In that area there, I believe truly that within 4 or 5 years, I think Jockey, I'm going to make a bold prediction, so everybody who's standing, sitting down, please hold on to your chairs. I think within 5 years, we'll do $1 million.
Wow.
I really do believe that, especially if we can get a couple real large sponsors to help us. And that's what that's what I'm good at, marketing and promoting this type of organization. So I think we have a bright future. And in doing that, I think the PDJ has a bright future because I'm blown away by a lot of these young men and women who are now riding wheelchairs, are living hand to mouth, probably someone below the poverty level, which kind of shakes me to the core. And so anything that we can do, that Jockeys and Jeans can do to make their life better, we're going to do it.
I love it. I love it, Barry. And so you were involved with that successful stallion season sale at Gulfstream Park here in January, this past January. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been involved. We've done two. We did 150,000 at Gulfstream this year. And the Stronach Group was very kind to offer a space and NTRA to let us come into their event, kind of like bulls in a china shop, but they did. And so we had a successful event the year before, which was our first one. We had a Gulfstream during our event. And we're hoping to make a big announcement here sometime in April about some stallion season plans. I'm not at liberty to talk about it directly now because we're in negotiations, but we're hoping that we'll have a great big announcement which will bring this to the next level.
Well, I can't wait to hear the good news. Can't wait, Barry. Can't wait. Former jockey Barry Pearl is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Barry, Jockeys and Jeans and the PDJF, they both have a very bright future with your help and so many others who are helping work towards building money for these unfortunately, permanently disabled jockeys. So what wonderful work you do. And Barry, now I want to talk about how you first became involved with the sport. And you started riding in 1965. But how did you first come to the idea that you wanted to do this for a living?
Well, this is a true story, although it may sound kind of interesting. I lived in a little town called Hialeah in Florida. And on my way to school, I used to walk right by the stable gate. Okay? And all the time, I'd see these little guys in big Cadillacs with blondes. I said, that's my job. That's exactly what I want to do right there. Whatever that guy's doing, I want to do that.
That's awesome.
And that's what I did. So I was like, I don't know, 15 years old, something like that. And on the weekends, I used to sneak into the backside. Don't tell anybody. And, you know, I'd walk around and like I knew what I was doing, which I didn't. And so one day I saw these guys walking hots. And I said to this guy that was standing in the shed, I said, I can do that. He said, can you? He says, yeah, I can do that. He says, I pay you a dollar if you walk them a half hour. I said, okay. So off I went. And I kind of was there ever since. So that was my first initial exposure to a racetrack. And I really thought every racetrack was exactly like Hialeah. Little did I know that that was not true. Because when I went to the next one a couple years later, when I started to get, you know, more into training, I went to Suffolk Downs and was kind of had a, you know, epiphany on what was going on in life. But Hialeah is probably one of my all-time favorite places that I rode. Gorgeous place. And Mr. Brunetti is very, very kind to jockeys and jeans. He's been a sponsor since the beginning, and we certainly appreciate that. So, yeah, that's how I really got started. Walking hots, and then I had a contract. That was the days when you had to have a contract. Mm-hmm. And I got a contract with a guy named Bill Sacco, whose sons are training, and that's where I got my start. And I was Mike Venezia and I were head and head tied for leading apprentice rider of the country that 1965 when I broke my maiden. So it was cool.
Wow, quite the accomplishment, Barry. And now Hialeah. So I've never been there, but. I went to Chris McCarron's jockey school, and he went on about how Hialeah was the most beautiful place. And if I remember right, he said something about flamingos. I'm not quite sure, but they would.
They still have the flamingos in the infield. Again, look at some pictures of Hialeah. It's just unbelievable. The building, the landscaping. Everything else that has to do with it is absolutely stunning. Now, you know, unfortunately, racing has changed quite a bit in this day and age, and it seems that if you don't have a casino tied to you, you got problems. Mm-hmm. That's just a game. That's just the way it is. And Hialeah's hanging in there because they do have a casino, and I'm glad of that because it is such a historic and beautiful place. Hedges that are 20 foot tall that surround the whole place. I mean, it's unbelievable. And it was a great place to ride because of the paddock and the area that the jocks room, and from the paddock to the racetrack, you go through a beautiful tunnel. I mean, it's just very cool. And they have the flight of the flamingos. I think it was just before the seventh race every day where a guy would go out and start the flamingos, and it'd fly up and back. It's just quite an experience.
Sounds like it. Definitely sounds like it, Barry. And so you rode your first race there at Hialeah?
No, I rode my first race. Actually, I rode my first race at Atlantic City Racetrack, which is no longer in business. And I won my first race at Garden State Park. That's where I actually won my first race. And I rode mostly in those years around, we used to run the Jersey Circuit, Garden State, Monmouth, Atlantic City, back to Garden State, then back to Florida, and which was a great circuit, you know, but you were a nomad. 30 days here, 30 days there, 30 days here. And it was, you know, of course, we didn't know any better, and so it seemed like it was normal until I could start riding full-time at one place. And I made my decision at that time to stay in, I stayed in Maryland, rode there, and had the great success there. But then I wanted to be a little bit further up the road, so I went to Pennsylvania after I was married, and I rode around the Libertyville, Philadelphia circuit for until I became the director of photography at Penn National.
You're talking about my places now, Barry, Maryland, Pennsylvania, the tracks I rode at as well. And you mentioned Atlantic City. And I was fortunate enough to ride Atlantic City before they shut down. And that was so much fun. You know, of course, there at the end, it was just a very short meet. But we'd all ship in, and the turf course was just beautiful. And, you know, the funny thing was that most of the people who would go to Atlantic City were from parks. And so sometimes it was hard for all of the outriders and pony people to bring all their horses to Atlantic City every day when they're working in the mornings at parks. And so half the time, you know, you don't have a pony and you're just trying to wing it and go out there with these horses that probably just came off the farm. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And so I would love to hear about your first race. Do you remember that day and what it was like?
It was like being in a time warp. You know, it was really strange. You know, you ride your first race. You know, the whole thing you want to do is get around and not, you know, run into anybody.
Right.
In all reality, so it was. I remember the name of the. I believe I remember the name of the horse. Although I don't remember the name of the horse I broke my maiden on. I remember this horse. It was called MV. It was a filly, and she was a nice little filly, and she just, you know, broke, and she stayed in about the middle of the pack, and that's where I finished. You know, just trying not to get into anybody's way or in any trouble.
Right.
And you know, then all of a sudden I went from that to 3 weeks later I broke my maiden, and I went from breaking my maiden to riding seven a day. So that was a whole different ball game, because, you know, in that amount of time, you really, you know, you're just learning that whole first 6 months to 8 months you're there, and you're just trying to improve, which is something that I did. I always considered myself a very strong rider, very athletic rider, and so, you know, I felt that I could finish real well on a horse and without, you know, knocking the heck out of the horse and you know, getting them off stride. So it worked out for me, as I said.
Well, Barry, we will be right back after this short commercial break. Stay with us, folks. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined tonight by former jockey Barry Pearl. And Barry, we were just talking about before the break your early days as a rider, and I would love to ask you who were the folks you rode with, and who did you learn from? Who was maybe your biggest mentor?
Well, probably my biggest mentor was Walter Blum. Walter and I have been friends for 40 years, and he kind of took me under his wing when I was a little kid and helped me out. But it was different. I think it was different back then, Christina. You know, everybody was super competitive, but, you know, guys like Jacinto Vasquez or Georgie Velasquez, they would see something you did stupid and maybe talk to you and say, you can't do that, or that's something that you don't want to do. And so I think it was more camaraderie in the room at that time. And, nobody ever got mad. Everybody gets shut off, right? I mean, we've all shut somebody off, and I've been shut off 50 times.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's just life. That's just the way it is. The game is an inherently dangerous game where, things can change for you in a blink of an eye. But usually people will do what they can do to help you and to not have that happen. Maybe there has been riders down the years that have, will more or less drop you in a blink of an eye. But I don't think I've ever run across anyone like that. If anything, I've run up against more people that, if you're in trouble, they will do what they can to help you.
And that's how it should be, because all of our lives are out there on the line whenever we're riding, and obviously the only sport where an ambulance follows you around the track. So it's very good that so many riders want to help, and they don't want to see anyone get hurt. And especially if they're behind you when you clip heels or whatever it might be,
they want to
help you learn, and that definitely makes sense. You mentioned also before the break, Barry, that you were a strong rider, you were a strong finisher, and did you struggle with your weight at all? Because it's very hard to juggle being strong, putting on muscle, and also maintaining that weight. Was that difficult for you at all?
I reduced like everybody else did, but I didn't have to like super reduce. You know, I'm a relatively small guy. I'm 5 foot. At this time in my life, I weigh about 128 pounds, which is not too bad for an old guy like me. I rode probably in the last few years of my career at 14 or 15, and I could make that fairly easily without reducing very, very hard. But I prided myself on being, as a kid, some of the things I did. I loved to weightlift for some unknown reason. I liked gymnastics. I was never real good at it, but I liked it. So I was always pretty physically fit. And even today, I'm not in bad shape. I walk 4 miles a day. I'm 70 years old. Not afraid to say that.
Wow.
And I walk 4 miles a day every day. And watch my weight and do what I can to keep in fairly good shape.
It's funny. I was just talking to someone the other day. It's funny how when I retired, and I don't know if it was like this for you, but when I retired, and I struggled with my weight a little bit. I'm 5'6", so it was a little bit difficult for me. But when I retired, it was still so ingrained in my mind. I went like maybe a year after my retirement before I had a piece of pizza. It was just so part of me, you know. That's all you think about when you're riding. You think about it all the time. I mean, how many times do you step on the scale before you go out for a race, after you come back? I mean, a lot.
Right.
So it was so ingrained in my mind. How was it for you when you first retired? Did you relax in that department at all, or was it just so much a part of you?
Well, you try to relax, you know. I'm fortunate. My wife is a great cook, Italian cook. So, there's a lot of food that she, but she understands, you know, what I should be eating and what I shouldn't be. And then I got to watch my health because I had some health issues, like everybody. But I've gone full circle. I've gone back to where now I'm on a kind of this diet, this plan, where I don't eat hardly any carbs. So mm-hmm. I don't eat bread. I don't eat pasta. You know, once in a great while, I might have some pasta. I don't eat cookies. I don't eat cake. I don't eat anything like that. And so I cut my carb rate down to maybe 50, 60 carbs a day, which is really nothing.
Nothing.
And
yeah.
I feel great. You know, like I said, it's a great way for me to, you know, keep my weight where I want it to be. Because if not, I mean, I blew up to 153 pounds, which for me is big. Mm-hmm. And so I said, wait a minute, this is stupid. And my doctor said, you know, this is not good for you, kiddo. This is not going to be okay. The outcome's not going to be what you're going to like. So I said, okay, I'll get this back together. So it's not too hard.
It sounds exactly like my jockey diet. I didn't eat any carbs.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about, Barry. But, yeah, it's not easy. Do you think that they should raise the weights at all? I know they've made some progress in that department over the years, but I've heard so many different opinions on that, and I would like to hear yours on that matter.
Well, you know, I think the weights are a real tricky slippery slope, more or less. I know I've rode with guys who are just would reduce their brains out, who were, you know, 5'4", 5'5", and you know, normally they should be 140 pounds. Mm. And so, you know, their longevity is going to be very short-lived because either they were young and they grew out of the business. I think the best people that would be, that would really could call those shots are not so much the riders, but are the horsemen, who know what these horses can carry comfortably. I mean, you know, the better horses, yeah, they carry 126 pounds, and probably 126, 128 might be the top of the scale. But I realize that these, you know, the kids are bigger. You know, they have to reduce. And so it's a very difficult thing for a guy like me sitting on the outside to say, yeah, well, you should weigh, or maybe some guy in a commission's office who never been around a horse's life say, yeah, that guy should weigh, you know, should only ride at, you know, 116 seems like a right number. Yeah. So I don't know, Christine. It's a very difficult and multifaceted question.
No, it definitely is. And I do think, as you mentioned, you know, the guys who really shouldn't be that small will always try to be smaller than they should. So, you know, it's like you said, kind of a slippery slope. But fortunately, you know, we didn't have to struggle too much. But also, Barry, something I would like to ask you, as far as you're so involved with Jockeys in Jeans and Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund, what do you think about jockey safety today? Helmets and concussions has been a big topic lately. What do you think? Are there improvements that can be made in that department? What is your opinion on jockey safety?
Well, they've come a long way since I rode. You know, they now wear the flak jackets. The helmets are better. Those type of things. But listen, I mean, in all reality, ladies and gentlemen, falling or a horse unfortunately breaking down and you going down was never the issue. You know, that's going to happen and you will survive that. The problem is when one of them in back, you can't miss you and they step in the middle of you. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that's going to save you from that.
Yeah.
That is where your catastrophic injuries usually come from, which is awful. I mean, awful. I mean, I've gone down many a race. And I never worried about hitting the ground because I always felt that I could survive that and roll through it. It was always worrying about who was in back you.
Yeah.
And that, I don't care what you have on, unless you have a Kevlar suit on, is going to protect you. So careless riding has to be looked at. You know, horses that just are bad actors. I have a story that I'll tell you. There was a rider that came from out of the South, out of New Orleans, Louis Spindler. I never forget Louis ever. And we were riding at Garden State, and we leave 3/4 mile. We leave the gate, and from jump one, the horse I'm on is trying to make a right turn. Okay, now we've all had that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously. And Louis on the outside of me, and I got this horse's head basically touching my saddle. Okay. left side. And we're coming to the turn. And I said, Lou, you're going to have to get out of here because he's gone. He said, not while I'm here.
Wow.
And I never forgot that. We made it all the way around the turn. He cost himself the race by not leaving me. And he became a friend of mine from that day. I mean, a good friend of mine from that day on. And I think that's something that would be would help if people would just pick up their heads and know where they're going.
Mm-hmm. That story gave me goosebumps. What an incredible, incredible story. What a wonderful thing for him to do. Like you said, it cost him the race, but he wasn't about to let you most likely get hurt. A horse bolting to the outside, that's never a good situation. And that makes me smile. That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a great story and a great kid. And Louis, he just, I was bouncing him off him. I mean, if everybody out there who's ever ridden a race, can imagine, I'm just like, I'm slamming into him, and he just got me. So, I never forgot that one. But safety in racing, as I said, Christina, we can have great helmets. We can watch for concussions. We can have Kevlar vests. I mean, I don't know how far out, far you go from there,
Exactly. Exactly. Former jockey Barry Pearl is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Barry, we got a little bit distracted. I would like to go back to where we left off with your story. And we were talking about your riding style. You were a strong rider, and you learned from some of the best, Walter Blum, Jacinto Vasquez, some of the legends you hear of. And what a wonderful opportunity had to be to learn from guys like that. And so you're riding on the East Coast mostly. And take me through the highlights of your career.
Well, I won a number of stakes around Pennsylvania, Flintlock, and a few others. I won some down in Florida. I stopped riding early in my career, as I've always said. I never could handle real well the fact that I could be maybe top five in one place and go to the next meet, and then it's like starting all over. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I got interested in photography. And when I did retire and decided to stop, I was probably at the top of my game. And I was riding for some great people, and I told them I was going to retire. They looked at me like I was out of my mind. What's wrong with you? You can't retire. You're riding so well now, and you're doing so good. And I said, I got those two little kids over there and that wife, and I have an opportunity to stay in one place all year long as a photographer at Penn National. And I said, I'm going to take the shot at it. So it was strictly a decision based on facts. Again, I had an opportunity to ride for some legends. I rode for Leroy Jolly. I rode for his dad, Moody. I rode for Alan Jurgens. I rode for William Kroll. George Handy. Andy George Handy is still around at 94. Don Combs won the Derby with Dust Commander.
Dust Commander.
Some really, really good horsemen. And, the kind of guys that you come back and you don't have to make an excuse for.
Right.
So that to me was a big deal. Yeah.
Of course. So that was in 1973?
Yeah, I stopped in 73. As I said, I was director of photography at Penn National. And we're only supposed to race there for, I think it was like 60 days. And the gentleman who was the president was a good friend of mine, and he called me. I had gone to Florida. He said, I'm coming to Florida. I want to talk to you. So I had already gone to Florida. I was riding down in Gulfstream and Hialeah and the old Tropical when that was running. And he said, we're going to get year-round racing up there. What do you want to do? I said, well, that's a heck of a question. Let me talk to my wife. And so we discussed it, and we discussed the fact that we could stay in one place, kids could be in one place. And I'm very family-oriented. My wife and I have been married, it'll be 48 or 9 years, for people say, how long are you married? And I tell them, I don't remember when I wasn't married. So quite a while. But it was a good decision on my part. Yeah, I missed the racing. I did for a long time. I felt that, you know, maybe I made a bad decision. But in the long run, and if you look at everything and you say, okay, you know, where am I at today? I'm very fortunate. So it worked out fine.
I would say so, Barry. And when you ride, as you mentioned, you were able to spend time with your family when you retired, and riders make lots of sacrifices in that department. And tell us a little bit about your family. You've been married for a very long time to your wonderful wife, and how many children do you have?
We have three children, six grandkids, and my oldest son is a CPA, works in Manhattan. My middle son, Matthew, was in the Air Force for 21 years. He works for a cancer screening company. He's an executive with them. And my daughter, she's a housewife. So everybody's doing well. The kids are great. The kids love having us around when we go back up north. And you know what's interesting, folks? You know, I know a lot of my friends, and I think it's kind of cool that they have all their memorabilia, you know, throughout the home, and trophies and pictures. I got one picture. That's all I have.
Really?
Yeah. So when people talk about, oh, you're a jockey, say, yeah, I was a jockey one time. I don't really get into a whole big deal about it. I don't know why.
Oh,
I mean, I guess it was pretty cool that I did that, but,
yeah.
You know, I just don't. But people who know me and know me well know how I am and my philosophy on that kind of thing. So it's all good. Yeah, it really is.
That's too funny. Oh, yeah. I have I don't know how many pictures around my house. Seriously. And that's so funny to me. That's so strange.
I know. It's weird. And I have one picture in my whole place of me riding. It was winning one on a horse called Kettle River. It was one of my favorites. Walter Blum got me the mount. Okay. That's
really?
Why I love Walter Blum. Yeah, Walter was riding it. We were at Garden, if you want this story.
Yeah.
We were riding Garden State, and I was making one of my comebacks. And like I said, Walter came to me and said, hey, I rode this horse last week. This is a nice horse. And I'm going to Montana hunting, and I'll get you on this horse. You're going to run down at Laurel. It was a Futurity Day. Matter of fact, the same day that Secretariat won the Futurity down in Laurel as a two-year-old.
Wow.
And he said, this horse will win. So it was a co-feed, you know, the pre-race before the Futurity. And so I went down, I rode him, and he just won easy. And I got to see Secretariat run the first time. So I came back. I said to Walter, I called him up. I said, you better come back here. This guy's going to run this in the opening day at Liberty Bell. I said, in a stake? I said, he's going to win. He said, no, you ride him. I'm out here in Montana. I'm going to be hunting, moose hunting or something. And I said, well, are you sure? He says, yeah, absolutely. So sure enough, the horse wins, gets me going again one more time. And so I called Walter and I said, well, I'll never forget you. You know, that was a big deal. And so that's how I got my the last start that I had, and then I kept going from there. So that's a nice story.
That's a cool story. He was too busy moose hunting. He didn't want to.
Yeah. Walter was moose hunting and wasn't coming back for anything. So, you know, that was good. I do want to introduce, if I may, our committee, if I could do
that. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And these are the founding members, the first ones. Darrell Brown, he's a founded member. Reverend Eddie Donnelly, I rode with all these folks. Barbara Jo Rubin, founding member, and myself. We now have Sandy Hawley as our jockey liaison. He's the guy that calls all the Hall of Famers and gets them for us. We have Gordy Gubin. Gordy is Barbara's husband, Barbara Jo Rubin. They were our auction coordinators and taking a little rest. We have Maureen Brown, Daryl's wife, who is our transportation coordinator along with Daryl. Karen Cole, who is kind of our secretary. She helps in a lot of areas. We've just added Carew, Scottfield Cessnaya. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows Carew if you're in Lexington.
Oh, yes.
as our one of our auction coordinators, and Susie Pacuotem, who is another one of our auction coordinators. Michelle Pearl, my daughter-in-law, came aboard this year. She's a big-time event coordinator down in Washington, and she's going to be working with our people to make sure that our parks event goes off with no hitches. And the last one is a guy named Benjamin J. Pearl, another one of my son, who's a CPA, and he just checks to make sure that all our numbers coming in and out, because we keep nothing. We keep $0. 100% of whatever funds we raise goes directly to the PDJF. So he just makes sure that everything's going right. And that's our committee. Great committee. Very proud of them. And we're fortunate to have such great people.
Sounds like a really good group of people. And you mentioned so many familiar names. Koru, actually, that's how I got your phone number, Barry. So it worked out well. We had her on the show a couple months ago. So, yeah, just wonderful, wonderful people working for something so great, Barry. And
Karu's a great guest. She's one of her and Susie are my favorite, some of my favorites. They're just super, super, loves jockeys and jeans. One of our biggest promoters. I can't think of anybody that would promote it better than they do. So it's good.
You know, Susie as well. Susie had her and her husband here on the show as well. And just great group of people you have there, Barry.
No, thank you, thank you. We like them. They're hard workers. They're independently minded, which is what I like. And we're all are interested in one thing, making sure this goes right, and we raise a lot of money for the PDJF.
What a great thing they do! And Barry, we were talking about how you decided to retire and become the track photographer at Penn National. And I've ridden many times at Penn National, shipping around from parks or Maryland or wherever it might be that I was riding at the time. And I got to say, that is probably the coldest place in the world.
Yes, it was. Spent many a winter up in central Pennsylvania. Great place.
Oh, yeah.
We were there for 35 years or whatever it was, but a great place. We raised our children in central Pennsylvania, and that was just a great place to raise kids. My kids never came to the racetrack, believe it or not.
Never?
No. Yeah, I mean, maybe when they were real little, but after – this is another one of my weird things. Because I really didn't want them getting involved. Uh-huh. With the track, especially the boys or the girl, I wanted them to do other things and be totally independent of it. And I believe that, like so many, and not saying it's the wrong thing. Most of the time, it's the right thing. People bring their kids; they get involved with the track, and there's two roads you can go down when you go to track. And everybody knows this who's listening to this show. You can go to the right road or the wrong road. Mm-hmm. And too many times, you take the wrong turn. It's easy to do. There's a lot of distractions. So I thought the best way for me to eliminate any distraction is not to have them. So I know that sounds weird.
No, not at all. Not at all. And you just keep them away. Go do something else. I
mean, yeah, what does Daddy do for a living? I don't know. Daddy goes over there, someplace. He goes and he comes back later today. Yeah.
That is too. So they never actually saw you ride in person?
No.
Oh, my gosh. No. Oh, that's so crazy.
I know. I bet my wife didn't see me ride maybe four or five times in my whole time.
That's
maybe
it.
Maybe 10 times. Yeah, because she just didn't happen. So
was she nervous watching you ride? I know my parents were horrified.
No, she wasn't nervous. My wife doesn't have a nervous bone in her body. She just was doing other stuff. Yeah, she was buying. She was out buying groceries, I think.
Did you meet her at the racetrack?
I met her at Monmouth Park, actually. I met her. She was going to college at Monmouth Park, and I had some friends that we socialized with that we were both friends with, and we met, and that was it. That was the end of the story.
The rest is history. Sure,
yeah,
that's
his sister. Exactly.
Mary, we only have about 2 minutes. I can't believe it. But I really want to briefly touch on your very successful photography career. Tell us about that. Besides Penn National, of course.
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about the end of my career life. I'm a realist, and I look at things in a very straight and narrow way. And I know nothing lasts forever, right? So when I got the concession at Penn National, I decided after a couple years to open up a studio, because you know every good thing has to come to an end. And I opened the studio, which was very successful. And so when Penn National and myself, we split ways, I had something to fall back on. It was great. So I kind of kept on going. From there, I got into real estate, bought a few properties. At 41, this is an interesting factoid, I had a coronary bypass. Okay. I'm now 70. And so I decided that I have to start doing other things and change my life around, because I worked 7 days a week, you know, 24 hours a day. So I sold up my studio and all the equipment with it, and decided that, hey, you know, I might be able to get in sales and be fairly decent at that. And so I did that. The studio was, like I said, very successful. I had only high-end clients. We did all the big weddings, social events, commercial work. And I got into my last sales job. I was a law firm representative for a company called West Publishing, and I sold the law to lawyers. I was one of three non-lawyers in the whole company. And so I would go in, if you ever been in a lawyer's office, you see all the books?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I sold. And I sold the books.
Really?
I sold it online, and it was probably one of the greatest career moves I ever made in my life. It was unbelievable, and that was a wonderful job, and that's where I finished my career out. So I had the studio. I did many things. I've been a jockey. I've been a photographer. I've been a sales guy, and now I'm a charity guy.
Mary, you have worn many, many hats, and I tell you what, we are all out of time here, Barry, but what an incredible story you have. It was great to spend the last hour with you, and wishing you all the best with your future endeavors, especially with Jockeys and Jeans.
Thank you, Christina. Come visit us. Tell Mike to come visit at Parks.
I will.
We'll have a place for you.
That sounds great.
All right.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can listen to. And don't forget, join me and the Big A, Anthony Stabile, tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. We will bring you 3 hours of live racing coverage here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.